Welcome to Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Each month, Galley Tables Storytelling hosts a live event in the Kodiak community. Storytellers are given 7 minutes to tell a personal story related to a monthly theme. Tonight, we're going to hear those stories.
Well, welcome to Galley Tables. Thank you to our musician over here, Dave Kubiak. He's super awesome. Give him a round of applause. Yes. We're so glad that you are here tonight. It's going to be an awesome night full of great stories. We'd like to thank our sponsors, KMXT and KDOK Public Radio, because they will actually be airing all of the stories that you're going to hear tonight. We want to thank the Kodiak Arts Council and, of course, the Best Western Inn of Kodiak, because this is their space and we get to use it every month. So that's great.
All right. Tonight's theme is Chance Encounters. I'm looking forward to some pretty good stories. Our storytellers will have 7 minutes to tell their story. When they get to the 5-minute mark, they're going to hear...
We are having the equivalent of a wardrobe malfunction, and we cannot find our noisemakers. So we will improvise, and they will hear some sort of noise at the 5-minute mark, and also some sort of noise at the 7-minute mark. 5 and 7. Hopefully we can find them before the end of the show, at which point then they'll hear the harmonica at the 5-minute mark and the duck call at the 7-minute mark. We apologize. So that's all for our intro. The show has been quite a feat to pull off. We did have 5 cancellations happen this month, and we were still able to pull it off with 7. So please give a round of applause to all the storytellers that came forward in the last minute. And with that, I'm going to introduce our first storyteller. His name is Marcus Dunbar. You might recognize him. He runs around town quite a bit. He was born in 1965. He came to Kodiak in 1997 because work brought him here. He's a PE teacher with the Kodiak Island Borough School District. He coaches cross country and track and field, and his family members are Kathleen, Miles, Trevor, and Hannah. His hobby is running, swimming, biking, skiing, etc. And there are no wacky or bizarre details to share on the questionnaire. So welcome, Marcus.
Thank you. So for my story, I'm going to take you back to 1981. And 1981, I'm 16 years old. I just finished my sophomore year of high school, just got my driver's license. And me and my friends, they're 17, Willie and Jim, we're going to go skiing up at Turnagain Pass. It's about an hour drive out of Anchorage, where I'm growing up and going to high school. So we drive out the road along the Turnagain Arm and get up to Turnagain Pass and got our skis. It's a Nordic skiing, so you know, the cross-country skis, and we put them on. Jim's a big skier, and so he's been teaching me and Willie how to ski a little better. We ski up the mountain, and we get up to, it's a beautiful sunny day. It's June in Alaska is great time. Sun all day long, and it happens to be a beautiful day. So we get up to the top of the mountain, great snow. We're skiing, and we found a plateau and a little some slopes, and we're doing a little telemarking. We build a jump. We're taking some jumps. And we spend just a couple of hours of skiing and having a good old time in the good weather. And then we're kind of skied out a little bit, so we sit down. We've brought a little lunch with us. We eat our lunch, and then we start talking. And young teenage boys, when they talk, they usually eventually start talking about girls. And in Anchorage, Alaska, in the early 80s, in the running community, when you talk about girls, boys, typically it ended up with one particular girl, Dee Dee Hawthorne. Now Dee Dee ran for Diamond, and she was gorgeous. She had a smile that could just light up a whole cross-country course. And, I mean, she always seemed to have a tan. And I think her legs came all the way up to her lungs and all the curves in all the right places. But probably the thing that impressed us most with Dee Dee was she could run a mile in 5 minutes flat. She was state champ in cross-country, and we were just in awe. So we sit there and talk about Dee Dee for a while. And my friend Willie, he was an artist. He took all the art classes. He majored in art in college. One of his favorite subjects of his art was my friend Jim. He would write comic strips about Jim. And Jim got he got in all kinds of weird situations, and I thought he should publish these comics, but he said, well, no one will get them unless they know Jim. And so I'll let you know a little bit more about Jim, but his comics were really funny. But this day, on this particular day, his subject was snow sculpture. And the snow that day was perfect for snowballs, for snowmen, and for snow sculptures. And so we decided we're going to build a snow sculpture. And our subject, the perfect subject, was Dee Dee. So we start working on this snow sculpture. And Willie had a meticulous attention to the detail of every part of the female anatomy. And I'm telling you, we worked for hours, and the results were spectacular. It was a snow sculpture that easily could have been in the Rendezvous parade and won prizes. But back in 1981, none of us had brought a camera. Cell phones didn't exist, so we didn't have anything to take a picture of this great work of art that we had created. So we decided we're going to leave it as is for nature. We've been on the mountain for hours, and we haven't seen a soul. So we're just going to leave the artwork there, and we decide it's time to go, and we start to ski down. We ski down the first little ridge, and all of a sudden, here come three young adults, two men and a woman, and they're super nice. They greet us, and, hey, great day out here. How's it going? And they start talking to us. Oh, yeah, you guys go to high school? You guys are on the cross country? You're on the track team? We're like, yeah. Do you guys know Dee Dee Hawthorne? And we're like, that's, wow, yeah, we know Dee Dee. And they, that's our sister. We're like, whoa, what? Now, what are the chances? Come on, we haven't seen anyone all day. We didn't even know Dee Dee had a brothers and sisters. And here we are running into them. And we got this naked snow sculpture just up the ridge. Okay, so we're thinking, so we say, yeah, we just built a snow sculpture. No, we didn't say that. We said, you know, it's kind of getting late. We got to get going, but... See, we're top position. We're getting out of there. We're embarrassed. We want to leave. So we get to the truck, throw our skis in. We're off. And you're thinking, okay, maybe they won't know it was Dee Dee. If only not for the fact that Willie had me get little pebbles and I typed out Dee Dee, running goddess of love. They're going to know it's Dee Dee. They're going to know who it is. So we've got to get out of there. So we're driving home, and we think, okay, whew, we made it. Okay, we're consequence-free, maybe. But I look over at Willie and Jim, and I'm like, you guys look like you got a lot of sun today. And they're, yeah, you too. And I'm thinking, ooh, yeah, I'm kind of feeling it. Well, the thing was, it was a beautiful sunny day up in the snow. We'd been skiing in shorts, no shirt, no pants, just the shorts, and maybe a little bit of tape on our thumbs so we didn't get blisters while with our ski poles. I've been up there all day, and my sister used to love to suntan, and she always had this Johnson & Johnson baby oil. So as we were leaving the house, I saw Johnson & Johnson baby oil. I grabbed it. We put it all over ourselves. We've been up there all day in this baby oil, no sunscreen, and we've just been fried. So we get back to Anchorage and get everyone home, and I'm waking up in the middle of the night. I'm throwing up, blisters all over my body. The sunburn is terrible. And then I the next day, I go over and see Willie, same thing. He's been doing the same thing. We're thinking, we better go look at Jim. Well, Jim, red hair, freckle face. Oh, Jim got it way worse than we did. He had the New Zealand splits that came way up to here, and he was sunburned way up to here. He's sitting in his lazy boy chair, and he can't even get out of it. He shed his skin a couple of times. And a couple of days go by, and me and Willie, we're recovered. And I told Willie I was going to tell the story. He goes, don't leave out the part about when we would go to Jim's house and ring the doorbell. So we'd go, it was like, we're all good. He goes, hey, let's go to see Jim. And we'd go up to the house and squat down low and ring the doorbell. And he'd go, come in. And Willie goes, shh, shh, don't say anything. Ring the doorbell again. Jim's, getting out of the lazy boy chair, coming over. And hey, what are you guys doing? And Jim, man, you still look like a red lobster. And so the thing is, red-haired, freckled-faced kids, they got no business rubbing baby oil on themselves going up on a snowy day in the sun because it didn't work out too well for Jim. It took 2 weeks before he got better. And the bottom line was Willie had a new subject for his comic book strip, Jim the Red Lobster. So he wrote those all things. But it was a great experience, chance encounter, and we never saw the Hawthorne kids again. So I guess besides the sunburn, we got out of it scot-free. Thank you. Thank you.
Next up, we have Thomas Huttner. Thomas Huttner came to Kodiak 2 years ago due to his work with the U.S. Coast Guard. Although he originally hails from Chicago, Illinois, he has come to call the Pacific Northwest home. He and his wife, Katie, learned to love hiking thanks to the gorgeous Kodiak summers and intend to take that gift with them wherever their journey takes them next. If you see them biking to work at 4 a.m, be sure to wave hello.
For every family that lives in Mexico, if they go back far enough, they have a Pancho Villa story. Some Pancho Villa stories are good, some Pancho Villa stories are bad. For my family's Pancho Villa story, the verdict is still out. For those of you who don't know, Pancho Villa was a Mexican revolutionary who fought from around 1914 to 1920 in the area of northern Mexico. Now, the problem with being a revolutionary is that you don't have access to the standing forces. You have to rely on brigands, bandits, and ruffians to do your work. Now, Pancho Villa's specific problem with relying on brigands, bandits, and ruffians is that they used the license that they were fighting under his name to raid villages. And when they raided villages, they razed every building down to the earth, they left no survivors, and they took no prisoners. Now, one such city was San Luis Potosí around northern Mexico, and one such family, one of the most prominent families there, had a daughter named Luisa. Now, Luisa is my great-grandaunt. She was 16 at the time. And her family's plan, should Pancho Villa's raiders come for them, was to load up Luisa with the most valuables they had, and for her family, it was silverware. Because if you had silverware in Mexico in the early 1900s, you were well off. You were doing all right. So one day, the people of San Luis Potosí get a visitor, and the visitor is from the next town over. He is bloodied, he is tired, he is traumatized, he is injured, and he tells them, Pancho Villa's men are coming for you. All the families load up their daughters with all the valuables they could carry. Again, for Luisa, this is the prized silverware. And their plan was to go to a dugout that was approximately 2 days' travel out and cover that dugout, once they were inside, with a heavy wooden door. They run to the dugout. They get inside of it. But 5 miles away, unbeknownst to them, was this shepherd named Fructoso, who was around 18 years old. Now, shepherds in Mexico at this time, the lowest of the low. The way I just described Luisa, exact opposite. The shepherds were dirty. They were smelly. They slept amongst the sheep to keep track of them. And they were really despised. So Fructoso sees all of these daughters and these village elders get into this dugout. And he thinks, that's weird. But he continues his travel. He goes to his next town that he intended to trade in. And his next town over was San Luis Potosí. But when he gets to San Luis Potosí after 2 days' travel, he just sees ash and fire and blood and corpses, except for one lone survivor, this 13-year-old named Alberto. Now, Alberto was Luisa's brother. The raiders didn't bother with him because he posed no threat. He was traumatized, but Fructoso needed to talk to him. He needed to put two and two together. So as he talks to Alberto, he realizes, yes, those girls are from this town. There are no survivors here. No one from this town is going to come to get them. Those girls will stay in that dugout out of fear, possibly until they're all perished. Fructoso decides that he needs to take action. In the meantime, Luisa is still in this dugout with all the other girls. They were not expecting to stay in this long. It was only supposed to be 1 to 2 days. They've run out of water. They've run out of food. A couple of them have passed away, and they couldn't do anything with the bodies because they could not risk broadcasting where they were, giving away the hiding spot. And Luisa is getting ready. She's having that fight or flight, but she hears this voice all of a sudden on the other side of the door. And the voice says, I just came from San Luis Potosí. Everyone there has passed away. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but I have to tell you so that you understand that Pancho Villa's men are gone. They're nowhere. They left. You have to trust me that it's okay to come out. I understand you weren't supposed to be in here too long. You have to trust me. And as everyone inside the dugout is talking amongst themselves, they're thinking, do we come out? Do we not come out? And Luisa's thinking, this is not my grave. I'm leaving. So she calls out to the voice on the other side, and she says, hey, I'm going to start pushing up on this door. You need to start pulling, because I'm getting out of here. And the voice says, all right. So as she's pushing up, and as he's pulling up, my family's not really sure what happens. Some of us think it's adrenaline. Some of us think it's true sentiment. But Luisa sees Fructoso, immediately falls in love. The eldest daughter of the most prominent family of northern Mexico falls in love with the smelliest, dirtiest shepherd of all of Mexico. Now, even though there's some debate about this chance encounter, was it adrenaline, was it true love? A lot of us say it's true love. And the evidence we point to is that for the rest of their years, Fructoso insisted on eating the way a commoner ate, which, for those of you not in the know, you roll up a tortilla and you use it as your utensil to scoop up the beans, the meat. And Luisa insisted on eating the way a prominent daughter would eat, which was by slapping his hand until he learned how to eat with a knife and a fork.
All right. Our next storyteller, Neil Mumy, was born in Indiana. He wanted to live in a small coastal town, so he moved to Kodiak 9 years ago. He works at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game as a computer programmer. He's single with no family members in Kodiak, but his friends are his family. His hobbies include dancing, woodworking, carving, boat building, sailing, fishing, hunting, camping, and shooting. Please welcome Neil.
How's everybody doing? So I am an adventurous guy, and I like to take my boat exploring and visiting new places, camping, fishing, hunting, etc. And I used to own a 15 and a half foot rigid hull inflatable. It was a very capable boat, and I would take it on long distance trips. For example, I circumnavigated Fog Neck Island, and when I lived in Anchorage, every year I would take it from Whittier to Montague Island to go deer hunting. And when you have a boat that is very capable like this and able to land on just about any beach and you gain some experience, I found myself getting rather cocky, and I would sometimes try to land on a beach just to test myself to see if I could do it. And if you do that enough times, eventually you're going to get slapped. And I've been slapped a few times. Such was the case 10 years ago in October. I decided to go deer hunting. So I left out of Whittier, and I set up my tent on Perry Island, and I decided to go beach cruising and visit all the small islands looking for deer. And I ended up on Lone Island, and it was pretty rough out, but I found a beach on the leeward side of the island where I thought I could go ashore. And so I set my anchor and I went hunting. And after a couple of hours, I realized that the wind had changed direction and had increased by quite a bit. And I was really concerned. So I started going back, and by the time I got to the beach, it did not resemble the beach that I left. It was very surfy. So you could picture like Mill Bay during a storm. And so I pulled my boat in, and I jumped in. And when I did, this large wave came over the stern and completely filled up the boat with water. And half of my gear came out, And so I stepped back to the stern of the boat, and I reached down to pull the plug out, because an inflatable, if you pull the plug out, most of the water will come out. Well, when I did that, the handle to the plug busted off. And you know those little rubber plugs that have the folding handle on them? Those don't work. If anybody sells those, take them off the shelf and throw them away. Use the ones with the little T handle. At any rate, I was getting pounded pretty good by the surf, and I was concerned I was going to get hurt. So I grabbed my dry box. I had my VHF radio in it, and I waded ashore. And I'm trying to figure out what to do, trying to gather up what gear that I can. I couldn't find my clothes. I had a dry bag with clothes, and I couldn't find it. I'm just looking at my boat thinking, how could I be so stupid to do this? And I'm 35 miles from the nearest town. So I realized that I can't do this alone. I need some help. So I get on my VHF radio and I start calling for help. Attention, any vessel near Lone Island. No response. U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard. Nothing. So I was alone on Lone Island. And I was totally soaked. And it was October and it was cold out. And I didn't have very much survival gear because all my camping gear was on another island. My boat was being destroyed by the surf, and I didn't know what to do. And I was out of ideas. So I sat down on a log, and I prayed to God. And when I finished, I picked up my radio, and I said that magic word, Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. Pause. This is the U.S. Coast Guard. And I'm not ashamed to say that when I heard that voice, it was a significantly emotional event. So thank you, men and women of the Coast Guard. Yeah. So after some discussion, they informed me that just by chance, the Chenega fast ferry would be in the area. And so they coordinated for the ferry to come over and rescue me. And so sure enough, here comes the ferry, and I can see them lowering their boat. And so I called the captain on my radio, and I says, you can't land on this beach. He says, you're going to swamp your boat just like I did. So I agreed to hike to an adjacent cove, which was out of the wind. And so I did that, and they picked me up. In the meantime, the Coast Guard had coordinated with a private vessel to take me to Whittier. So they transferred me over to another vessel, and I went home. And the next day, I came back with my friend Brad, and I wanted to recover what gear that I could find. And I thought that my boat was just going to be an insurance claim at this point. And we found the boat, and it was high up on the tide, and it was full of water, and it had 6 inches of gravel in it. So you can tell how much it got totally trashed. But it was completely undamaged. I was stunned. The tubes were fully inflated. There wasn't any holes in the hull. The motor seemed like it was okay. So I took the water out and pulled all the gravel out, and we got some logs, and we rolled it down the beach, and then we hooked up a jumper cable, and the motor started up, and I drove it home. Thank you.
Our next storyteller is a Wadham boy. It says I'm not allowed to say whether it's Jay or Keller. He was born in Nome. He came to Kodiak in 1985 because he was 2 years old and did whatever his parents told him to. He works as a pilot. He has a wonderful wife, Katie, and 2 girls, Andy and Meyer. His hobbies are exploring, and under any wacky or bizarre details, he says, I have a twin brother and twin sisters. So welcome up, Jay.
Okay, this is the first time I have ever been here, and I promised a street and Sarah I'd come yesterday, and then totally forgot about it until 7:52. When I was getting my kids out of the bathtub, and I got a text from a street. But I have 2 stories to tell, and they're not going to be very detail-oriented because I didn't really have time to put it together. But the first one was my first elk hunting event with my twin brother, my dad, and a local dentist that used to live here, Knox Christie. And I was 12 years old at the time, and it was back in 1994. And both my dad and Knox Christie had their own airplane, so we didn't just get dropped off. But there's an elk herd up on a Fog Neck Island, and they're Roosevelt elk. And we had flown over and found them, and we landed at a lake we call Iceberg Lake now. And it's a really teeny tiny lake, and set up a camp there. And me and my brother were really excited. This was great. We're going to go out elk hunting. Yay. And so you start elk hunting, and most people that have been elk hunting know that when you get back and go to the store, a $40 steak looks real cheap to you and real easy. You're like, man, I'm just ready to go right there. So we go off, and we finally shoot some elk somewhere that we shouldn't have shot them way too late at night. And we actually went back to camp, slept. We, you know, got to the animals, hung all the meat in the trees, and then wandered back into camp like 2 in the morning, and it was like exhausting. So the next day we got up, and in that time, we decided it was going to be better because we had to ferry out of this really small lake that we were going to hike into this bigger lake that was even further away from camp. And that's called Waterfall Lake. And in the talk of walking around and talking, we understood that there was a cabin there. And so we hauled 2 loads down to the lake. And then on the 3rd load, Knox and my dad went back to the other lake. And then we were to bring the rest of the meat down and meet them at the lake. And they beat us to the lake. Got the airplanes, we got to where the meat was, and half of it was gone, and that was just it. Well, and all that talking and all that time, we're like, okay, we're just gonna wait here with the meat, and they'll come back. Yeah, that's way too far to walk. And so we're like, okay, it's beautiful, it's on the west side of the island. For all of us that live in Kodiak, we know that this might have been built in the wrong spot. You can drive to Anton's, and it's sunny and beautiful, and in Kodiak, it's foggy, and you're like, what the heck? And so we're sitting there, and then we decided to take a nap because our bodies were just completely exhausted and sore. And we wake up, and we start walking around, and we're like, man, they're not coming back. And so then when you're 12 years old, you're pretty nervous. Your parents are your life. Like, did they crash? Did they this? Did they that? And again, this was 1994. My parents grew up in a different era. We did not have a VHF radio. We didn't have sat phones. We didn't have anything. We were just sitting there. We had some hunting packs with some twine and stuff we thought was important at the time that definitely wasn't important now that we were where we were. And so we knew there was a cabin there. And Keller's like, well, there's a cabin here. He's like, maybe you go this way and I go this way. And I was like, no, we got to stick together. I'm like, well, let's just wait here a little bit longer, you know. And you're kind of, your parents, I have two twin sisters. So you get yelled at enough that you almost don't want to tell your parents anything or do the wrong thing because you're going to get in trouble. Like, well, we don't want to leave. So we waited till what we thought was the last possible moment. And they're like, okay, something's happened. We got to go to the cabin. And then we're like, well, there's a logging camp we could hike to, too. Now knowing what I know, that we would have never made it. And so we're like, okay, we're going to start walking along. Well, there's just north of here, you got old growth, 400-year-old old growth, thick as spruce trees. They're tall, and you can't see anything. And so we start meandering down. We see a buoy, and it's a water limno buoy. We know now it has nothing to do with a cabin, but we're like, it must be down there. That looks good. And so we start going, and you can hear a plane coming from a mile away, and all of a sudden we start hearing an airplane. We're like, oh, that's an airplane. This is great. And so, sure enough, my dad comes over, lands, and it's just him. Knox is not with him. We're like, okay, something must have happened with Knox, or maybe he just got stuck or whatever. Something happened. But he's here. Well, we're a long ways away, so we start going, and we had gone probably a mile and a half. And in that time, we hear my dad yelling for us, and then he gets in the airplane and starts taxiing the wrong way. And so we're, like, running as fast as we can. At this point, it's twilight. It's dark out, you know. Like, we're running, and we don't even have flashlights. We have nothing. And we finally, he turns around and he starts coming back, and me and Keller are like, well, are you going to go out in the water? Am I going to go out in the water? And like, you know, so because the trees go all the way to the beach, you can't get there. So finally he sees us and he comes over and picks us up. Well, what had happened is the fog had moved into Kodiak and they were just stuck. So the theme's Chance Encounter could be child abuse depending on what era you grew up in. But, and then the other story I have is, fast forward about 15 years, I'm flying for a lodge, and I have to take clients from another lodge over to a bear viewing spot on Fraser Lake, which is awesome if anyone's never gone bear viewing. And so I go to pick up this family, and it's three girls and then the two original parents. And so we jump in the plane, and we start flying to Fraser Lake, which is really close. We're going from Larson Bay to Fraser Lake. You land, then you walk down. And in the airplane, you know, it's kind of a weird dynamic. There's these three, you know, 26, 27-year-old, really cute girls. I'm like, 27, too. I'm like, okay, this is cool. And then there's the dad and the mom. And we start talking. Well, it's the mom, the dad, the two sisters, and then the dad's new girlfriend. So, and it was already a really weird dynamic. So we got that out of the way. And we end up going down to the bear viewing pad. And we get down there, and there's all the other bear viewing guides. And, like, you know, from other lodges and other, you know, they're dressed up in their Sitka gear and stuff, and I'm wearing a sweatshirt, and I have my sat phone case so I can talk on the phone, and you go and you sit on the pad, you watch the bears, and you walk back, done it thousands of times. And this particular time, we're walking back, and there's a spot in the trail where you kind of get up, and the two daughters were up forward with the mom, and then the dad and the new girlfriend were a little bit back, and there was a mom bear with two cubs, a sow and two cubs coming up the trail, and the two cubs were running, and they ran right into the mom and the two daughters and knocked them over. And in that process, everyone gets on two different sides of the trail. Well, alders are kind of the invasive species. We've seen that in the shoots and stuff. And so the trail has alders all around it. And so there's half the people on this side, half the people on this side. Everyone's, like, screaming and yelling, and the mom just turns. And when a bear's really going to kill you, it puts its ears away so they don't get damaged. And she just starts coming. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is not good. I don't have a gun. I don't have anything because, you know, why would you carry a gun? That wouldn't be smart. And I had my sat phone case, and it's an orange pelican case, and I just sat down. She was barreling at us. I just, rah, right into her nose, and it hit her in the nose, and she just went right past us and kept going. So we stop, and we turn around, and the dad is gone. The mom and the three other younger girls or huddled up on this side of the trail. We have to go back and get him. And then all of a sudden, the three girls were friends, and the mom and the dad was kind of just off there by himself. And we walked back, and I went right down to Size Sporting Goods and bought a 45-70. I carry it with me everywhere I go.
Next up on our lineup, we have Eleanor Ramos. This is her brief biography. She's been to Galley Tables just a few times. She was born in Long Island, New York, decades ago. She lived 3 years on Copacabana Beach, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And she moved to Kodiak in April of 1987 after being hired over the phone for a part-time job with Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She's currently retired, but sometimes she accepts short-term temporary assignments like telling stories at galley tables. And she maintains a fairly busy social life and some volunteer activities. You've probably seen her all over town. She loves to travel, limited only by time and finances and certain physical limitations. In addition to most of South America, Mexico, Costa Rica, and the Caribbean, and Turkey, other travels include Afghanistan, Spain, Russia, China, Tibet, and Sweden. So you guys want to go anywhere, talk to her first. She has only one sister, Nancy, who still lives in Long Island, and she spent a year here and returned several times since. In July, she generally flies back to New York, and they drive together to their annual convention of the Balalaika and Domra Association of America. Did I say that right? All right. Man, you have so many hidden talents. She loves all kinds of music, her favorites being ethnic folk and classical. She likes trying odd foods, and she likes almost everything she's ever tried. She's most comfortable around water, particularly salt water, gentle waves, and preferably non-hypothermic. So, welcome everyone, Eleanor Ramos.
Okay, when I first heard that it was Chance Encounters, I said, well, Chance, what does that really mean, Chance Encounters? And so it's something that wasn't planned, something that wasn't expected. So I also thought, well, shall I do one big long lead up to a chance encounter? Or I grew up in New York, and I don't remember what you just said in my bio, but I've had a lot of interesting jobs, and one of them was working with did you get that in there? Probably not, a world famous, two people over 40 perhaps, a sports celebrity. And through him, I met an awful lot of famous people. I got very blasé about working with the entertainment and recording industry. One of my other favorite jobs was driving in New York City taxi on the night shift for 2 years. And I met some pretty interesting people that way. But the first encounter that I'm going to tell you about shortly was as an average citizen. I hadn't worked with fame and fortune yet. And so the first person, I lived on 70th Street and Columbus Avenue in Manhattan, and I worked at 61st Street in Broadway, and it was a short walk to town, to work, and I saw these people trying to push a car out of a snowbank. So I figured, I've always been on the large side, and I said, I'm not real strong, but I can certainly push toward it. So we're pushing, and the snow is blowing, and everybody's got their hoodies up, and when I stepped back, the person that I was helping push a car out of a snowbank with was Sidney Poitier. So that in itself was pretty exciting. But then I walked to work, and I worked on the third floor, and on the top floor they had a kind of a recording studio that people that were filming in New York would do little touch-up things. And as I was pushing the elevator to go to my third story job, Sidney Poitier walked in the door and asked me if I was going to his floor, and I said, I wish, but no. So that was the first one. And then the second one, I worked in an organization that shared office space with a company called the Institute for Public Transportation. And this was in the 1970s. It was a big deal. And we were lobbying for bike lanes in Manhattan. And we got them, actually. And the big rally started at Columbus Circle, and I cycled down to the World Trade Center. And then this is younger, more agile days, cycled back up to the Museum of Natural History. It was quite a trek. But as we were gathered at Columbus Circle, I was the only one riding a bicycle in a skirt, and I was the last one in the group. And I had a friend take a picture, and standing next to me was Dustin Hoffman. So that was, okay, there are people who know who these people are, because when I started to give my little rehearsal speech and I was telling a friend, she said, well, you know, not everybody knows who these people are, so I said, you might have to explain it. So, okay, so back to the sports celebrity. Did you mention it? Oh, you're going to let me? Okay, world famous soccer star Edson Arantes do Nascimento Pelé. I was his personal secretary for 3 years, and through him, thank you, long story. And through him, I got to know hundreds of people, famous people, and I got, like I said, pretty casual about it, and I didn't usually get very rattled. But one day, somebody poked their head in my door, and they were asking for an autograph, and it was Christopher Reeve, Superman. So, okay, you know who he is. That's good. We're batting 100 here. 1,000. And then the other one was, I'm always running late. It's something that I do, not on purpose, but I was running late. And I was trying to reach the elevator, and there was somebody holding the door open for me, and beautiful tweed suit, clean, crisp tie, polished shoes. Someone whose stage presence I'm not really keen on. He usually wears a wife beater t-shirt and his tongue is hanging out like this. And it was Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones. And he said, "You going up, love?" Yeah. So he worked on the 13th floor and I worked on the 15th floor. So I got to see him fairly regularly. And I also got to be friends with his, I don't know, his secretary assistant, but Sheila Maria John from Trinidad Tobago. But at any rate, so that's who I saw in the famous world. There's one more, but I'll tell you that one. That's the dessert here. So then, okay, I'm not working with LA anymore. I worked with some pretty mundane office jobs. And I had this little bug that I wanted to drive a New York City cab on the night shift. And I did for 2 years. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And people would come and go. Sometimes I'd recognize them, sometimes I wouldn't. Arsenio Hall was one. Howard Cosell, there's very few people here that know who Howard Cosell is. Good evening, sports fans. Who else? I had somebody from Earth, Wind, and Fire. Oh, boy. Okay. Who else we got? Peter Jennings from the Nightly News. I didn't know who he was, but I said, "You have a wonderful voice. You should be in broadcasting." And he's, oh, okay. And I also picked up this fellow, coincidentally, on 52nd Street. Let's see who the music buffs are. Any guesses? Okay. Has an album by that name. And it was Billy Joel. And I did not recognize him. He did not look away. I saw him. I saw him in concert 3 times. And I told him I was going to Alaska, and he was kind of pretty nasty about it. He says, "Well, good luck." He said, "Good luck." I said, "Who doesn't love Alaska?" You know. And I said, "Have you ever been?" He said, "Yeah, have had a concert there. Had some concerts there." And I said, "Oh, you're a musician. What instrument do you play?" And he said, "Billy Joel." I said, "Oh, you play with Billy Joel." I've got Mr. Piano Man in my car. And then when at first I thought he was somebody trying to pass himself. I'm looking in the rearview mirror, well, maybe. So I said, "How was the wedding?" And he told me all about the wedding. And we were friends after that. But perhaps the biggest chance encounter that I had, and I've told this to many of my friends many times, "You got to tell that at galley table." So this is my dessert. Okay, so I'm working in Pillay's office and friends with most of the secretaries or receptionists on the various floors. One of them was, her name was Linda Soto. And I've always been pretty heavy, but I've always been agile up until recently. And I took belly dancing lessons. And most of the stuff that I was learning were these kind of shoulder things and hip things and doing that kind of stuff, hip rolls, and sorry, I can't do it. But I had learned some floor exercises, and I would give anything to be able to do this for you now, but I cannot, so please use your imaginations. I'm on the floor, kind of doing this stuff, and really big hip thrusts, and Linda is laughing politely at first, and gradually she's going into convulsions, and she is hitting the desk with ferociously. I said, "Linda, come on." I said, "I know it's funny, but it's not that funny." And she points over my shoulder, and I kid you not, closer than that railing is to me, is someone standing there, cowboy boots, blue jeans, little shearling jacket, little leather hat. He's going like this. And it was Robert Redford. And I wanted to die. I wanted the floor to open up. It did not. He was very gracious, and he backed up slowly. Kind of the way you're supposed to back away from the bears, you know. And he went into his office, and I'm trying to get up gracefully and ready to kill Linda for not stopping me sooner. And I ran into the elevator bank, and there were six elevators, and I'm pushing the buttons, push, nothing's happening. Meanwhile, Linda's still laughing. That was on the 20th floor, and I have to go down to the 15th floor. So I finally got in the elevator, and I said, oh, thank God. And bing, somebody holds the door open. And yes, oh no, Redford gets in the elevator with me. And I was ready to die. And like I said, I used to be around celebrities all the time and was never, you know, so flustered as I was then. And I wrote him a little apology note. Sorry for, and I got an autographed picture, which is in my house. If you ever come to visit, I'll show you my autographed picture. Thank you.
Our next storyteller is Abby Dustin. She's a teacher at Kodiak Middle School. She enjoys reading and won the superior ribbon for cross-stitching at last year's Kodiak State Fair. And you can see her play Betty Ford in the upcoming Fairwind Players production of Tea for Three next Thursday and Friday at 7 p.m. in the Gerald C. Wellson Drama Pod. Just saying. Please welcome Abby.
One more plug for the Tea for Three show. If you want to know what it's like, imagine if the first ladies of the United States came to Galley's Tables and told you all the crazy things that happened backstage in the White House. That's what the show is like. And it's going to be great, so please come and see it. Some of you may remember, last year I told a story at Galley Tables, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It was about when I was a Mormon missionary on an airplane and I watched the woman sitting in front of me die of a heart attack. And it was really depressing and it bummed everybody out. This is sort of the unofficial sequel to that story. It's about a chance encounter that helped give me an emotional resolution to what happened that day. It is also from when I was a Mormon missionary. Nobody dies. They go to the emergency room, but nobody dies. It happens about a few months after the plane incident. I am a fresh-faced little Mormon missionary serving in a little just outside Glasgow, Scotland. It's a beautiful spring afternoon. I'm with my missionary companion because no Mormon missionary travels alone. We're like Hostess snack cakes. And my companion then is Sister Petman, this wonderful, sweet, adorable little British woman who's just one of the nicest people I've ever met. And we're walking down the street with our bright, enthusiastic, ecclesiastic smiles, ready to talk to people. And as we're walking down the street, we see some people in the distance, and we're excited, and we're ready. And as we get closer, I realize they're Neds. And Ned is a British slang term, N-E-D, non-educated delinquent. They are inebriated ruffians who wander the streets looking for trouble. And their beverage of choice is something called Buckfast, which if you're from Scotland, you know, is a high alcohol content, caffeinated wine, which I didn't know existed. So the alcohol removes your inhibitions and the caffeine gives you the energy to follow through, which is a recipe for disaster and property damage. But you know, I don't want to judge these people before I meet them. So we keep walking along, about two men and about three women, and one of them's carrying some sort of big bag. And as we get closer, the two men start sort of playfully shoving each other. And not too concerned yet. I start putting out a hand to stop Sister Petman from walking because she's nearsighted and she never wears her glasses and she's blind as a bat. And then the shoving turns into grappling. And the two men are grappling each other and it starts turning into a fist fight and they drag each other off into this parking lot. So Sister Petman and I immediately go over to the young women, and we realize they're not young women, they're old girls. They're like 15 tops. They're just wearing a lot of makeup, it was hard to tell. It's like, are you guys okay? Do you need to call someone? Have they hurt you? This bag they're carrying, it's not a bag, it's an infant. And they're like, no, we're fine. And then one of them starts screaming. And we look to where she's looking. This fist fight is no longer a fist fight. One man, Ned One, has Ned 2 on the ground, grabbing his head, slamming it into a car bumper. Then he gets him on the ground and he starts slamming his head into the pavement, drops him completely, kicks him point blank in the face, and runs off. And suddenly we realize all the girls are gone too. So there's this human being who is now lying in a puddle of blood on the ground. And my mind works in a way that in order to process and handle this emergency situation in a constructive, useful way, I need to pull back from it and sort of pretend, okay, this isn't real life anymore, this is a movie, and now we will continue. Sister Petman and I run over to him, and I'm thinking he's dead, or he's permanently paralyzed, there's brain damage, he can't walk away from this. I feel like recollection is probably exaggerating, but there's so much blood. Sister Petman immediately tears off her jacket and is like using it to like cradle this man, because she's just like heard this little British Florence Nightingale, it's amazing. And she's like taking care of his immediate like physical needs, and I'm pulling out the cell phone and calling 999, not 911, because we're in Scotland. And I get on the phone like, ring, ring, ring. There's been an altercation. We are at like 1615 so-and-so street. A young white male scientifically describing what's wrong, because that's what I do. And Sister Petman is keeping this man conscious, and I'm on the street directing the ambulance and the police cars in. They get out, they start this man is alive. I can't believe this man's alive. He should be dead. The EMTs start taking care of him, and then the police come over and they ask for a witness report. Now, I have been watching crime shows since I was 6. This is what I trained for. Would I be able to give an accurate witness statement under duress? And I did. It was perfect. I described everybody, all 5 of them. And I was like, she was like 120 pounds, white, light-skinned female, dark bob hair with a turquoise sweatshirt and a tongue ring. And the police is excited that I'm giving so many details, but he hears my American accent and he realizes, oh man, my paperwork does double. So we finish filling out the information. The EMTs clean off this guy enough so they can figure out who he is. They know him. This happens all the time. P and his friend always have these bust-ups, and yeah, he's just used to it. So that eventually gets cleaned up. Sister Pepin and I look at each other like, I think this is good for this evening. I think it's time for us to go home and reflect. So we get home. Sister Pepin takes off her jacket. Thank heavens it's black, so it's not going to stain. She's going to throw it into the washing machine. And then all of a sudden I hear this, it's got blood on it. When she was throwing her jacket into the washing machine, she had taken off her missionary badge. All Mormon missionaries wear that big black badge on their shirt that says like Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in their name. And it's black, but the side of it is white. And she's holding it and she realizes it's got blood all over it. And that's when we both sort of stop. And it stopped being a movie. I realize that just happened. It just happened. We just watched that man almost die. And there's a few moments of silence. She's just like, I'll go wash it off. She's walking when I grab her. I'm like, no. Go get your journal. She's like, why? Just do it. Go get your journal. She does. I was like, here's what you're going to do. You're going to wipe off some of the blood onto the page, and then you're going to laminate it with cello tape. And she's standing there in disgust. And I'm standing there in disgust. I can't believe what I've just said. And as I've thought back on that moment, I've started piecing it together, and I realized why. This blood on this name badge, it wasn't a talisman of tragedy. We didn't just watch a man almost die, because I knew what it was like to watch someone die while literally strapped to my seat and unable to do anything. We didn't just watch someone almost die. We helped someone live. I realized what an absolute gift that was. I couldn't stop senseless death. I couldn't undo the mindless brutality, but I could give thanks to God for the fact that I was able to take even a small bit of action and to help make the world a little bit better. And I'm just so grateful for that. And I want to just share with you that, yes, tragedies happen, but each of us will have opportunities to help, and we should just be grateful for those.
Our last storyteller tonight is just in town visiting. And she asked when this event was, and I told her. And then I asked her, do you want to tell a story? And she said she would. So Juna Davidson was born in Kodiak. She came to Kodiak in 1980 because she was born. She's currently living in Olympia, Washington, and she moved there in 1998 to go to Evergreen with all the other hippies. Now she manages an AmeriCorps team. She waitresses at a brewery. She volunteers with the local burlesque troupe and tells stories at, I think it's Storioli. It's a community event, much like Galley Tables. This is her first time enjoying Galley Tables in Kodiak, and she's so excited to be here. Thanks, Juna.
Okay, you can hear me. I'm not going to hold the microphone because I have poor vocal control, and if I hold it, I'll either be yelling or whispering. So if you can't hear me, like, wave. So I'm Juna, like Sarah said. I grew up in Kodiak, and I was glad about the topic for the storytelling tonight when she asked me if I wanted to tell a story. One, it's kind of a chance encounter that I'm here. I've wanted to come to Galley Tables since it started, and every time I come home to visit my family, it's never when Galley Tables is happening. So it's really exciting to me that I get to be here. I love storytelling. I love listening to people's stories. And so when Sarah texted me today and said, hey, you want to tell a story tonight? I was like, well, what's it about? I have a chance encounter. And it wasn't that long ago, actually. I work at a child welfare agency in Olympia and manage an AmeriCorps team. And we were having our holiday party on December 8th, way back last year, 2017. One of my really good friends who worked there was having kind of a hard day. Her partner had died recently, and it was hard for her to be at the holiday party and seeing all the couples, and her partner had worked there too, and she was kind of feeling stressed out. And I was like, you know, we're down here at the Doubletree Hotel in Olympia, Washington. Let's take our wine to the lobby. I'm waiting for someone else. We'll drink some wine, have a chat. I thought maybe I could kind of make her feel more comfortable. So we go and we sit in the lobby, and we've got our wine, and we're sitting there talking, and as friends do, it kind of got a little heavy because she was having a hard time. And all of a sudden, she grabbed my hand deeply, and I was like, what? Looked up, and I grabbed her hand, and we start mumbling to each other. Like, literally, that's the words we were saying. And we've got our wine, and we're shaking our hands around because this big, tall guy had just walked in the front door. He was wearing track pants and a parka with a fur hood. Which, Olympia's actually not that cold in December, but I happen to know that this guy lives in LA, because it was fucking Jeff Goldblum. And a lot of interesting people come through Olympia, and we get a lot of famous, like, musicians and performers, not a lot of movie stars. Movie stars go to Seattle or to Portland, you know? And she, I'm a huge Jeff Goldblum fan. I still think he's hot. And she likes him even more than I do. And finally, we were like, okay, we're going to let him check in. And then we're just going to say hi. And we're so excited that everyone we work with is down the hall. And we kind of secretly hope that none of them come out so we can brag about it, you know? And so he finishes checking in, and he heads to the elevator. And she jumps up. And she, cool as a cucumber, says, oh, I didn't know you were coming to our holiday party. And that was better than my opening line. I had this moment, and I was like, you know, this is really making her day. Maybe I'll just let her have that. I don't need to meet a movie star. And so I sat on the couch for a minute, and they're like right here. And then I was like, oh, but I really like Jeff Goldblum. And I'm so embarrassed by this. Luckily, I don't think he noticed. But I stood up, and I had my wine glass, and I went, because, like, I still wasn't sure I wanted to interrupt their conversation. And finally, I was like, don't take the wine. How are you going to shake his hand? So I put my wine glass down, and I went over there. And he was so kind. And he gave me a big hug. And he's like, oh, well, you smell good. I was like, well. And then, you know, we chatted. And the first thing I really said to him was, so do you drink coffee? And my friend looks at me. And he's like, well, actually, no, I don't really. And I was like, oh. Do you like pastries? And my friend later, she's like, I was really wondering where you were going with this. And he's like, well, you know, I do like pastries. And in my brain, I was thinking about how I waitress one day a week, and when people come to Olympia from out of town, I like to recommend cool places to go. But I was really failing with Jeff. He was not interested. He was obviously tired. He was really, really kind. And chatted a little more. He left. And as he's walking off, he comes to me and he says, well, have you guys ever stayed at the DoubleTree Hotel? You know, when you check in, they give you a warm cookie? He gave me his cookie. He's like, I think you should have this. And I was like, thank you. And he left. And my friend and I were like, and she says, oh, can I share the cookie? And we had this real dorky, like, fangirl moment. And we were like, we should not eat this cookie. And so we went back into the party, and we bragged to everybody. And we would, like, show them our cookie. I put it on Facebook. Then all my friends started posting, like, I'm going to go out tonight. I'm going to find Jeff Goldblum. Apparently, he didn't go out. It was his last night staying in town. And he left the next morning back to L.A. What's even weirder about it is that when I found out why he was in Olympia is, most of you probably have no idea, but outside of Olympia, about 30 miles south, is a really, really, really small town called Tenino. And outside of Tenino is an even smaller town that's like a mile squared, and he was filming there for this movie called The Mountain that's about a psychologist. I had never heard of it. I Googled it that night. I lived in Pocota for 9 years. I was like, Goldblum's in my hood. So that was pretty exciting. That's like one of my best celebrity encounters I've ever had. And I know you want to know, I do not still have the cookie. But the only reason I don't still have the cookie is because on Monday, I thought about how excited my friend was and about how sad she had been before and how this like magical chance encounter changed her whole night. And so I wrote her a little love note that said, I think Jeff wants you to have this. And I put it in her mailbox at work.
Galley Table Storytelling is made possible through a partnership with the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation. Visit us online at galleytables.com to find the date and location of the next live storytelling event. You can also browse our archives and listen to past stories or sign up to be a storyteller. Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life.